One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
What's happening, friends? And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives.
Yes.
With me, Cam Hale, and of course, in studio, with the cold toe like I got, Mr. Kyle Fils.
How's it going, everybody? I'm here in studio. I'm ready to go, brud.
Ready to rock.
Man, I've had a fast-paced day today. I cannot believe how fast this week's gone by, and especially today. You ever have one of those weeks where it's like you wake up and you're like, tomorrow's already Friday?
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
I'm just with you.
Running and going. Well,
it was one of those deals. I got up this morning. There was ice all over the windshields.
Yeah.
I ran out. I scraped all the ice. And it's like you're trying to get it all done before, you know, and I'm starting cars. And I'm getting my wife's and my daughter's done and mine done. So you can get ready to go to work. And I get all that done. And we blast off. And it go, go, go. Mm. And you get done with that. And you come back and go, go, go. And you look up and you're like, oh. And like you said, then you look up and you're like, huh, it's 9 o'clock on Thursday night. Like, what just happened?
I didn't even eat.
Like,
I forgot to eat all day.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, speaking of the weather situation,
yeah.
I know we talk about weather a lot at the intros of the show, but look, we're old men. How do they get it wrong, so wrong, and do we really need meteorologists anymore? I mean, because like they said earlier in the week that it was going to be 70 degrees by Friday. Yesterday morning, I was wearing shorts before lunch.
Yep.
By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, it had plummeted 25 degrees.
Yes.
And now it's raining and cold and ice, like you said.
Yep.
They never said that. And then they're like, oops, oh, that's Texas weather, folks.
Yep.
Do they say that everywhere? Do they go, oops, that's Iowa weather, folks? I mean, is that just like a saying everywhere? Why do we need a guy to give me the breakdown of the week? Like, tomorrow's high is going to be 72. The low is going to be 44. Thursday's going to be sunny.
Yeah.
I'm like, I've got an app on my phone, bro. It tells me all that.
Well,
plus more.
I'll take it even deeper than that. Why do you need to go to school to learn how to do it?
It's the only job you can have where you can be completely wrong and you're not liable.
You can pay all this money to go get a piece of paper saying you know what you're doing. And then when you get out and go to work, you don't have to even prove that you know what you're doing.
Right, but back in the day.
So that's my thing. It's like, why go to school? I could be a meteorologist right now.
Why do they also tell you not what's going to happen, but what happened today? Today's high was 92. Yeah, I know. I lived through today.
Yeah,
it was sunny today.
I'm worried about
pollen
what's going
was
on.
Up. Yeah, I was sneezing. I was aware of that.
Yeah,
the winds were 10 miles an hour. Yeah, I remember I walked outside. It was windy. Thank you.
Yeah.
What's it going to do? That's all I care about.
When does it stop?
Oh, like it's snowing in Chicago. I'm like, well, I don't live in Chicago, so that really doesn't have any bearing on me.
That's why I have an app.
Yeah.
Can you and see even the, jet the stream? App was wrong.
The jet
because
stream.
The app will call it one time, and then you refresh it, and it's wrong again. You're like, I don't
know. You want to hear something even more bizarre?
I'm going to quit looking at it.
I have a WeatherBug app on my iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
My wife has the WeatherBug app on her Android phone, and they'll both have different forecasts. I'm like, only the platform is different. How's the forecast different?
A house divided.
I don't know.
A house divided.
I'm stupid, folks, so. Save yourself the time. Because if you send me an email trying to explain it to me, you're even more stupid than me.
That's right.
All right, let's move on. Let's get into the news. This was a pretty interesting story sent to us by one of our listeners. Now that she does not want her name revealed, so she will remain anonymous, or we can use the code name Tanya. Because I just like the name Tanya.
I do like the name Tanya. Every time I hear the name Tanya, I think of the girl that smacked the other girl in the leg with the
Tanya Harding.
Yeah, that one.
I always think of the singer. Delta Dawn.
That's Tanya.
Oh, that's Tanya. My bad.
I guess you pronounce it. No, nope. Tanya's with an A. Tanya's with an O, right?
I don't know. I've heard
that's
with
Tanya
a.
Tucker with Delta Dawn.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or what is the, no. What was the better one? What's your mama's name? Yeah, that's the one. What's your mama's name?
She owns a bunch of cutting horses here in Parker County.
She's here in town all the time. You bump into her.
Yeah, that's crazy.
She didn't hold up. Okay, moving on.
Moving on. She says, I am writing because I had an encounter. I live in Georgia and grew up living in a funeral home. That's a whole nother story, but I digress. We have about 6 acres and our house sits in the middle. It is wooded all the way around. We are right outside of the city limits, but when you come onto our property, you'd think you were way out in the country. Anyways, one day I was lying in bed and looking out of my windows. The windows cover one wall in my room. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw a huge black shadow going from one tree to another. I thought my eyes were playing tricks on me. This happened again a few times on different days. So I told my husband, son and daughter-in-law about it, and they just shrugged it off. I guess they thought I was crazy. One morning, my son had gone somewhere, and when he returned, he came into the house and told me I was right. He had seen it too. That morning, when he got into the truck and started it up to back out, he looked out of his rearview mirror, and it was black even though the sun was shining. He turned to look at it, and it was gone. Now, one day, my son and I were outside and was burying my grandson's dog that had gotten hit by a car. We were out in the open field, and all of a sudden, a huge shadow came over us, and we looked up expecting to see a big bird, but nothing was there. One morning, my son and daughter-in-law, who was pregnant, was headed to her doctor for an appointment. They saw it again, and it seemed to be following them. Then it was gone. She found out that day that she had miscarried. I told a friend from England about it, and she said we needed to pray over our land, our animals, and our family, and the sky over our land. We walked around on our land and prayed over everything. I failed to tell you that we have some chickens and cats, and they had been dying and were being killed by something. Anyway, after praying 2 or 3 different times over the land, it stopped. We have never seen it again, and my daughter-in-law is having a baby that is due in March. And she and the baby are healthy and fine. I needed to tell someone about this. I don't know if this has happened to anyone else. SH. That's kind of creepy. Something.
I thought it was Tanya.
Well, that's the code name.
Oh, I got you.
That's the code name. It's a secret name. It's a pseudonym.
That's
it's
right.
Tanya, because this person doesn't want their name revealed. But something dark and ominous was lurking about on their land, killing animals, and I guess she believes putting a curse on the family. And through praying over everything, it left. You know, you talk to people that walk around their house with sage. They burn sage. Yep. They do little things. And, you know, from a lot of accounts of people that have poltergeist or spirits or ghosts in their house causing problems, sometimes just something simple like that actually makes it stop. Or they're like, hey, whoever you are, opening the doors, and say, you know, you're dead. It's okay to go towards the light. Move
Knock
on.
It off.
Knock it off. We just moved in here. And then sometimes it angers the ghost. The ghost becomes, you know, causes more problems. And then sometimes they stop. They knock it off.
Is it the belief in the sage or is it the sage itself, do you think?
It's got to be the belief in it. Because what would difference if you were burning basil or burning cedar or anything else?
Well, your eyes would swell up a little bit if you were burning cedar.
But you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I think it's like a placebo, right? Like you just a belief that it's doing something. But then it does something.
So that's what I'm saying. Is it the sage or is it the belief? Do you need to burn something?
I don't know.
Can you burn Afghan Kush? Would you be burning that while you're walking around in there?
It must
that
work. I don't have any ghosts in my house. Anyways.
That might make you think.
These are jokes, folks. Sorry.
I just wonder because
or maybe they're not.
Here's what got me thinking about it. It's like when you're out in the woods, And there's like, you know, where the mule deer live in the sage areas lots of times.
Yeah, uh-huh.
There can't be any ghosts out there. It's full of sage. It'd be the safest place to be.
You would think. It's not safe for mule deer.
Paranormal talking. Well, if you're there, they are. But
yeah, I don't know. That is an odd thing.
I just want to know about the burning. You know what I need? I just, anybody that's got any input on that, is it the sage itself?
Are there other things that people burn to get rid of spirits?
Exactly. That's what I want to know.
Wolf's bane, right? That's what gets rid of werewolves. If you have wolf's bane.
Is that what it is?
It's some kind of flower. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you're supposed to deliver it to the werewolf, though. Do you just like wear it? Do you consume it?
So when he eats you?
I mean, yeah, I don't understand. They just say that like wolf's bane, it's silver. They don't like silver. You know, there's all these rules.
Yeah. And I always like, is it the silver? Or is it the high powered delivery system the silver comes in that they don't like?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm like,
And then they changed the rules. So like now, before vampires couldn't step in the light. Now they can put sunscreen on.
Yeah. And they twinkle.
Now they twinkle. I mean, who's changing all these rules? I don't like the new rules. I like the old rules.
The vampires are changing because it's easier for them.
That's true.
Daywalker.
Yeah, the Blade series is really good.
Yeah.
I heard they're going to bring that back.
I wish they would.
Because that's I don't know if that's a Marvel.
It is. It's Marvel.
Yeah.
I wish they would. I'm a big fan. Brett, I got you something here because you know how much we love Sasquatch stories, especially that take place here in Tejas.
Yeah.
Lon posted this, and it's mischievous Sasquatch in Southeast Texas.
Ooh.
He received this from a fella or a young woman that goes by the name G.G. Gennady Golovkin, maybe? I don't know.
Oh, maybe.
This is what we're going with.
My mother-in-law.
Maybe
she goes by GG.
That's true. This is what it says. It says, I grew up in Southeast Texas, about 40 miles west of Houston, and lived on a small farm. Now, sometimes at night, there'd be something screaming out in the fields from time to time. My neighbors heard it as well. And one morning, while waiting for the school bus at the end of our driveway, I looked down and noticed a very large barefoot print in the sand. The heel had been run over by my dad going to work, but the rest of it was plain as day. About 12 inches long and at least 7 inches wide was still exposed that you could see. I knew it was a Sasquatch print. I wanted to show someone, but here comes the bus, and I had no time to run back home and to get my brother to take a look. So that afternoon, when I got off the bus to see the track again, so many cars went in and out of the driveway that day that it was now completely gone. And I was sure disappointed about that. I tried to tell my brothers and a few friends, but all they really did was not believe me and kind of chuckle. There was a neighbor in the 1970s who lived on the property directly north of ours, and he went deer hunting and shot one and then took it home. He tied the deer up to field dress it hanging him from a tree limb, and his wife called him in for breakfast, and after he came out to field dress the deer, he looked and saw the deer he had tied up was now no longer there. He noticed it been drug over a fence and into the woods, but he never saw what had gotten it. Everyone said it was a big cat. That's what got it. But looking back now, I know that big cats pick up their prey with their teeth and walk forward. This deer was being drug. Cats don't drag anything backwards. And how would a cougar be able to pull the deer down from the rope it was tied up with? If it was a big cat that got this man's deer, the big cat would have been the last thing he saw going over the fence and into the woods, not the deer. So anyway, I was talking recently to a friend of mine who had grown up next door to me. He's in his 50s now, and I'm in my mid-40s, and he told me he went fishing in the 1990s on a lake that was on the property where the man had his deer dragged off. He said while he was walking up to the lake in the woods that he saw some trees that had the bark stripped off them about 9 foot up off the ground. And it looked like there were claw marks on the bark as well. Well, while he was fishing there that day, he began to get the feeling of being watched. That made him feel very nervous, and then he noticed a very strong, musky odor that he had never smelled before, and he got the heck out of there real fast. He said when he goes to visit his parents' place that he can still smell that smell from time to time in the air. He also said that he and his brothers would hear whistling and whoops on the property, but never saw what was making the noise. He said they also heard stuff walking, what he believed was on 2 feet, on their property at night, but he never saw any of that either. Another incident in the exact same area in the 1960s, where some guys who went swimming at the lake one evening, is about a half a mile from my home. And while the two brothers and a couple of friends were swimming, their car horn starts blowing. Now, there were no houses close by, and they thought that my uncle was over there kind of messing with them. And they got spooked because they could not see their car since it had become dark. So they get out of the lake, grab their flashlights, run over there to where the car was parked.
Uh-huh.
They told me that there were very large footprints all in the sand around their car. Now, they knew that this wasn't their uncle messing with them. And, of course, because the prints were so large, it would have to have been an extremely large person to have left it. But nothing was ever said about a Sasquatch. They just thought some large man without shoes on had done it. And one more thing that happened to my older brother and cousins makes me think, too, that it was a Sasquatch. My mother had a twin sister, and they were always doing stuff together. So one evening, there was a special at church, and my parents and my aunt and uncle went to it. My older brother and cousin stayed at my aunt's house while the grown-ups were all at the church. Long story short, my aunt and uncle had a cattle farm, and they had dogs that were the kind of, you know, mean per se, but they did not like, you know, take a liking to people much. They always stayed outside. Now, my aunt's place was 200 acres, and it was a large place, and while my brother and cousin were there just watching TV or whatever, the dogs start whining outside. They had 7 or 8 of them. Now, these dogs never came inside the house, but they were scratching at the door wanting to get in. Then they hear what sounded like something scraping the window screen in the living room. This was in the summertime, and the windows, of course, were open. That scared my cousin and my brother bad enough to go lock themselves in the bathroom until our parents all came back from church a couple hours later. Now, my brother said that he was in the 10th grade at the time, and my cousin would have been in the 7th. My brother said it sounded like something was scraping its fingernails on the window screens, that it would do it at one window for a bit and then go to another one and do it. He said whatever it was went around the entire house on all the windows, scratching on the screens. I thought about these things off and on that had happened to my brother and my neighbors and my cousins a lot growing up. And after putting two and two together, and after some other things I experienced as an adult, I look back to those weird events back home, and I now believe it was a Sasquatch that had done these strange things out there in my parents' place.
Huh.
So, what do you think about that wildness, Philly? It sounds, I mean, look, it does sound like he sees a footprint, a deer. We know people who've had animals go missing.
Right,
the
yeah.
dogs are, you know, freaking out. Things like that. It's not something that a coyote would do, or, you know, it's and a big cat. A big cat's not going to come scratch on your screen.
It's just some person fooling around.
Why would you continue to do it? Yeah. Why would you continue to do that anyway? I mean, it's honking horns.
Most people don't understand. Most people that listen to the show, from people from other countries to other parts of the nation, they don't understand that East Texas is solid woods.
Yeah.
A lot of woods. Like, yeah. I think only Alaska probably has more forests.
Yeah, that's it. We are second only to Alaska.
It's very squatchy.
Well, and also, too, like we talk about, and there's other farmlands up in, you know, all up in the Midwest and all this stuff where your neighbors are far apart.
Mm.
And in East Texas, it's a lot that way. There may be a mile or two separating you from neighbors, but that mile or two is solid forest.
Solid.
Like walking through it. Like it's one of those when you walk into it, like you had talked about being in Humboldt County, like the sun doesn't come down all the way.
No.
That's the way it is out there. You walk into this dark black
20
forest,
yards off the road, you can't even turn around and see the road.
Yeah, it's that thick. So there's all kinds of stuff. That's like when we always talk with Lyle. Off air, whenever we always sit around and start just discussing it with Lyle, we always get into this. Is it so thick out there? Like, man, something people could hide out there. There's some really odd things could take place out there.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of people hiding in the woods, folks, when we get back from the break, I'm going to be discussing a couple of stories about hermits that I really, truly enjoy. And I think you will, too. So we'll jump back. We'll dive into that. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to COSI starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at COSI.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Perfect. Everything just fine. We're keeping everything moving
while the All right, y'all, what is happening? Yeah, this is what I've been wanting to discuss for a while. It's a conversation my wife and I have had several times. It's always a joke with her and I that she was the only reason that I stuck around in this civilization. I have a real hard time being here, knowing that there's places out in the woods and knowing there's things to go and explore. And I enjoy doing it. I enjoy doing it alone. I could easily find myself being one of those hermits in the woods, living up in the mountains, things along those lines. Those are things that I enjoy. And I don't know why. It's just something that I truly, truly enjoy. And I've not done it for, you know, longer than 3 or 4 days, I guess, solo out in the woods. So I can't say, yeah, I could live that way, hands down. I don't know if I could, but I don't have a problem doing it 3 or 4 days. I could probably easily do it a week, you know, or maybe even longer. I'd like to try it just to see and find out. But what I want to discuss with you today is people that have done it. It's different. And I think it's something that it's something that more and more people over the years are probably going to start breaking away. I feel like there's going to be a division later on to where you have people that go the traditional, we're going to be in society, we're going to be in civilization. And then you're going to have people that refuse to have cell phones, refuse to do these things. There's always been outliers, but I have a feeling like it's going to take a big separation and it's going to really change later on. So these are some people that have already had that separation. A couple of stories that are a couple of my favorite stories. One I'm not going to share today. I'll have another one. I'll have a third story later. But these are two that were self-imposed. And it's just a real unique story. We may have discussed a little of it before in the past on the show, but when you bring up the name Lykov, it probably doesn't jar anybody's memory. It wouldn't mine. Nobody really thinks of anyone's last name unless, you know, it's something silly, you know, some Kardashian name or something that we know that's in front of us all the time. But this was a family of what was considered to be old believers in Russia way back in the 30s. And they were heavily persecuted because of their religious belief. And even after the Soviet Revolution, the authorities at the time still followed through with religious persecution. And that they would gather up the old believers and put them on work farms or, you know, put them in prison. So to keep that from going down on their family, the Lykov family gathered together and headed off into the taiga, headed off into the deep forests of Siberia in Russia. Now, I don't know if this was everybody or if it was just certain groups, since there was a lot of religious persecution and a lot of people fleeing that kind of tyranny that it went down this way. But I do know in the 30s that in that area of Russia, that it was illegal to hunt and to fish. And I believe it was only for the certain religious, what they called the old believers, the old Christian faith, because it was another way of forcing them to come back to civilization. Like, if we catch you hunting and fishing, you're going to be put in jail or we're going to kill you on sight. So the only way you can get food is if we give it to you, type thing. So in order to not be thrown in one of those prison camps or not be used in that way, the Lykov family, of course, slipped out, you know, headed into the woods. I believe they were even brought about claiming that they were poachers. And so during this time, they were some, I guess you could call them game wardens, Russian game wardens. I'm not even sure what they would really be called, but ended up killing the brother of Karp Lykov. And Karp was the, you know, he's the head of the family. And so these guys shot and killed his brother. And it says, you know, accidentally, but they claim that Karp, and he was old believer Lykov, and his family are all the old believers. So the game wardens, if you will, claimed that, oh, well, they were carrying guns and they were fighting back. So that's the reason that we shot, you know, and killed the brother. So I do know that at the time, and I don't remember what the acronym for it, but let's say it's like KGB, old school KGB from the 30s were involved in this. And they came and visited the Lykov family. And it's almost like a Jewish persecution as well. You know, these old believers just, you know, like this. So what do? But they have to run. So this is in 1937. So Karp and his grabs his family and they take off deep. And I mean like deep into the woods, like move in. And of course, back then the woods aren't like the woods are now. What I mean by that is everyone went into the woods. It was just one of those things, right? So because of that, everyone was, it was kind of like going to the park or going to the mall. I mean, everybody used the woods for other things. So what they would do was they would move and set up camp for a little while the Lykov family, and then cover up their tracks and move again and move again. And they were moving further and further away from civilization. And they did that, of course, to stay ahead. And then once you get into that rhythm and you're trying, you know, you think you're outrunning the evil that the men that are chasing you are trying to persecute you, you get into that rhythm. So there's no telling really how far they went the first few months, you know, as whatever it was, as they continued to go. But one thing that we do know was that they stayed in 100% total isolation until 1978. So 36, 37, right around that time, until 1978. Now in 1978, there was a helicopter pilot and he was doing a survey, flying over some of the forestry area there in Siberia. Now what he was doing was that there was some geologist in that area that had been doing some work and all that. And he was trying to find a clearing area that he could set his helicopter down so he could fly the geologist in this area and set it down. And he said he saw a clearing. He's like, well, that's a perfect spot. Here we go. So he starts buzzing the clearing. Well, when he gets up to buzz the clearing, he noticed that the ground has been furrowed for like a garden. So there's furrows out here. And he's like, well, the only reason it'd be furrows is if someone lived here. Now, he said that the mountainside that this sat on was 150 miles from the nearest settlement of people. So he's like, there's nobody. And he even went on record to say that they had done their research and that they had known in this geological study where they were at that there's nobody living in this district of Siberia, in these counties, or, you know, it'd be like somebody finding in the middle of Yellowstone, there was a little hut out there, you know, that, like, no, it never showed anybody living here. So he finds all that stuff. He's like, we don't know what is going on here. So he goes back to pick up his geologist buddies. Now they're, like I said, they're looking for iron ore is what they're, you know, out there checking out for. So he tells them, he's like, hey, look, this is what I just found. You're not going to believe this, but there's something crazy going on out here. So the geologists are like, hey, take us, go show us what this is. So they jump in the chopper and they take off. So he lands up in this area and it's up near the top upper reaches of the Abakan River there in Siberia. So the geologists are like, there is a garden. There's vegetables growing. There is a garden. Like, what is this? So they come strolling up and they notice that there's a little cabin. They said it was just a single room cabin and that it wasn't very tall and that it was, you know, just a musty, almost, you know, it was a cabin, yes, but not like a cabin that you would see in these beautiful magazines. Like, it is barely held together. I mean, it's one of those things you're like, there's no way this, that somebody's living in there. The geologists report that they go in there. You know, it took them a bit. You know, they get in there. There's people in the cabin. There's a rapport that goes down, and finally, but the geologists were finally invited in. Said that the whole floor, of course, is a dirt floor covered in potato peels and pine nut shells. It had been stomped down to make a floor. So for all this time, that's what it had turned into. Now, they said the really wild thing about it was they were like, well, there's got to be just one hermit living out here. But there's not one. There's not even two. There were five. There was a family of five living in this little house. And so the geologists sat down and they start talking to them. They're like, how did this happen? What do you know, who are you? What are you doing here? You know, we're curious. What's happening going on here? So during the time that the Lykovs have left, Karp and his wife ended up having two more children while they were in the woods. Okay. So you've got to imagine they have, I believe it's Agafia is the main character. She's the one that we'll probably be talking about the most. And then I believe Dimitri, I think, was her brother's name. So yeah, Dimitri and Agafia. Now, neither of these two had ever seen a human being in their life that was not their family member. Wrap your head around that. They were born into the taiga, into the Siberian forest. They had never seen someone outside of their immediate family until 1978 when these geologists showed up. Now, the geologists talk about this, and this, you know, spawned a whole big thing. The geologists said that they had used like birch barks and all these things, and they had made shoes, and they had used like hemp cloth to build things. They had replaced a lot of stuff. And they said the thing that was the hardest was they had brought kettles with them and bought pans and pots and stuff when they had gone out. But over all the time of being used in the fire and then washed and used, that it had worn holes in them. So they didn't have any way of like really cooking, boiling, making stews. And that was gone because they couldn't make anything. And they didn't make anything out of clay. None of this. They just were basically doing without because you can't put them in the fire. They also let them know that they were always growing, you know, always taking care of their garden. But in 1961, it killed the entire crop. Now I do remember another part of the story that they would set around the clock and watch after their one potato plant that they tried to keep warmed, where they knew they had to keep seeds for the next year. And they ended up being able to pull that. But the mother, her name was Akulina. Akulina, being an amazing mother, I guess is the only way to really put it. Most mothers probably listening to this is this kind of mother. So her children wouldn't go hungry. And they were forced to eat their leather shoes and the bark on the trees in 1961. Because of that snowstorm, that freak snowstorm that wiped out their crops. Akulina chose to starve to death so her family could survive. They didn't have enough food for all of them, so she died so her children would be able to eat more shoes and more whatever. So she didn't eat it all, and she died because of it. So as it goes on, now the geologist said they were trying to help, you know, the family, and the family wouldn't accept it. They were not having it. The geologist finally got them to take salt. And you can only imagine they probably haven't had spices or anything like that in no telling how many years. I mean, that's something that probably ran out in the first year or two. So, you know, you could say years they haven't had anything remotely close to this. And then over time, the geologist got them to, and I remember hearing them, you know, they would bring them like knives and forks. They brought them some more pots and pans. I think they brought them a flashlight. I think they eventually took some to a different camp or took them somewhere where they could see what a television looked like or a radio. I mean, like these things are, it's crazy. So this is 1978. They haven't seen any of this stuff. These things are just blowing them away. Like, you know, they have no idea what's happening. So then some people say it's like 81, 82, right around in that area. The children, the four children that were left, three of them pass away all within a few days of each other. Now, when you say children, we're not talking little children, you know, in 81, we're talking adult children, grown children, but yet It's still Karp's children. And so around that time, they all pass away. Dimitri, the brother, is the last one left, not to pass away. You know, he's sick, but he's dying. So the first two are gone. Dimitri's there. And so they're like, hey, we can help him, you know. Agafia, she's still okay, right? And so they're like, what are we going to do? You know, what can we do? And they're trying. The geologists are like, let us take him to the hospital. It will be fine. Let us take him to the hospital. And Dimitri refuses to go. He refuses to go to the hospital. And so there's, you know, different people back and forth, you know, are claiming that this is what it was. Now, there was a fella named Vasily Peskov that actually wrote a lot about him in the 80s also. And people blamed him for it because it wasn't the same timing. But I know the geologist got blamed and Vasily got a lot of people were like, you know, these people wouldn't have died if nobody would have messed with them and all this. But Vasily ended up showing up after they had passed away and had found, you know, the one with the sister and the other two brothers that had passed away and the fresh graves. And he talked to Agafia and to Karp at this time. And it started being one of those things where they would still bring them supplies out there, but they're still 150 miles from anywhere. So you fast forward from 81, 82 to 1988. And Karp, the father, he passes away in 1988. So now it's Agafia. She's the only one left out there in the forest. And you're thinking, all right, time's up. You're done. Come on back into town. You know, everything's good. You know, you don't have anything tying you here. Negative. She does not want to leave. I do know that, like in 2016, she ended up having a little issue with her leg and she was flown out and then went right back. And, in 1990, I do know that she moved into town and she tried to live there, in a covenant for like the old believers, right? She was going to be a nun and she even became a nun in her religion. And yet she turned around and went back, moved back into the taiga. So this woman's in her mid to late 70s at this point in her life, right now as we speak, still living out there in the taiga. In 2011, the officials of the Russian Old Believer Church is what it's actually called, went all the way out there to the taiga and carried on a baptism just for Agafia. So they baptized her the way she wanted to be done. The authorities in the area, and even this, and I'm not even sure what the area is actually called now, but the authorities then, and even now, help also. They make sure she has supplies. You know, they kind of keep an eye on her all the time, even now. But I do know that she has come and gone, and there is like doctors go and visit her. People volunteer, bring things to her. In 2015, there was even a film crew went out to shoot a documentary called The Forest in Me. And if you go on YouTube, you can go on Vice. There is a documentary about her and about the family and the whole thing. And I believe that's where I'd actually first saw it was on was this hermit documentary that had been done. But I get it. You get the persecution. You get the idea that once you've been out there, it's not that strange to think about living out there. You're living off the land. You're living with your family, your immediate loved ones. If you were born out there, you don't know any different. The hardships of winter, you're never warm. You're never really clean. You're never really dry. I mean, you're living just like, and for us, of course, it's crazy to think this way, but human beings survived like this for thousands of years. This is, in my opinion, living like that is how we were actually meant to live. Not in this crazy rat race with this electrical stuff that I'm talking into and coming into your ears and all this. And none of this is meant to be what we're supposed to be now. Like, that's why more and more people, even if you go outdoors, even if you take a vacation, nobody takes like a vacation to go into crazier electronic zones and crazier. You like to get away from it. Let's go to the mountains. Let's go to the beach. You know, let's go somewhere where we can, in air quotes, relax. You go to these places because it's almost like unplugging, and it's like the solitude of nature will help you out, will help you get to feeling better, get over some of what you're going through, even today. And for me, it's almost like that's almost like a religious experience itself, being in this form of nature. So these people left because of persecution. Now, I have a book that was written about a fellow that I really enjoy. I want to share this story because this is one that is kind of the other way. Is this man just made up his mind one day to just walk out. If any of you know the name, and a lot of people you listening probably have even lived up around there or live there now, about the North Pond Hermit. This is takes place in Maine. This took place in 1986 when it started. There was a young man at the time. He was 20 years old. His name was Christopher Knight, and he lived in Massachusetts. And he drove to Maine, walked into the woods, and vanished. That was it. Gone. He did not have another conversation with another human being for almost 30 years. And he was finally caught when he was breaking into a cabin up in this area. Now, I tell you this, this is where it gets pretty wild. Now, the people that have done the research, and you start looking and reading the books and reading the articles and stuff about it, his family was very private, okay? He had four older brothers and then a younger sister. Now, they say the family was very private. They also say that all the children of his family, including himself, were extremely smart. Now, they said they were lower middle class, is what it says, so they didn't have a lot of money. But what they did do is the parents made sure they were intelligent and worldly as far as through their readings, and that every evening they would all read like poetry. The whole family read and conversed about Shakespeare. Like, they would dive deep into these subject matters and teaching you thinking, and I guess more like an introspective thing. Now, here, of course, it sounds crazy. In our day and time, to me, 1986 wasn't that long ago. You know, I was like 11 in 1986. But today it may sound weird. Everybody's on their phone. Everybody's on the computer, things like this. But back then they didn't have a lot. So what they did have, they spent time together. They also say that the family, as a family, learned about automobiles. So they were, I picture one of those families that is able to fix anything. Like, the kids are out working on an old broken down washing machine and going to turn it into something else and repurpose it. And that they even, they had greenhouses there. They also had a lot, they saved water. They said they worked on thermal dynamics. They had all kinds of stuff that they would use better and make their greenhouses to where they could operate their greenhouse on no electricity. Just, I guess, basically like solar and heated from different things anyway. So they had gone into really off grid back in the day before off grid was a thing. Now, they say, and we always say they, it's written that Christopher was extremely shy all of his life. Like, this didn't just come up one day. Like, he was this way all the time, and that he had a real hard time interacting with people, that he didn't really know how. He was extremely socially awkward. And so the story goes that at the age of 20, he got into his car, he drove up into the woods of northern Maine, got out with a backpack and just a few items, put the keys on the console, and walked off into the woods. And the family never called the police. The family never filed any kind of missing person report on Christopher. Never, you know, never got suspicious. Maybe he's dead. Maybe he's this. Maybe he's that. Nothing. Nothing at all. And the police were even questioned about it. And the police were like, man, it's really, honestly, not really strange. First of all, there was no crime. If there's no crime, what do you, I mean, you don't see any signs of foul play. The car's just parked, you know, when they found the car. The family's a very quiet, you know, kept to themselves kind of family. You're over 18. You're an adult. You can walk away from anything at any time you want to. There's no crime against it. You can just leave. So the police not being involved was no shocker at the time. They were like, no, it's really not a thing. There was a man named Michael Finkel, and Michael Finkel wrote a big article in GQ for about this whole thing. Now, the cool thing about Michael is this, is he actually, Michael got to sit down and interview him, got to talk to Chris, and find out a lot about him. Well, I say a lot. As much as you can. And like I said, he wrote a great article. I'm going to read you a little of it here and there as he talks about it. But he, in his article, he talks about Chris left camp, you know, late one night or around midnight one night, and was actually slipping around, because what he would do was he would break into cabins that were left, I guess, untouched or unoccupied. Let's say if you had a cabin up there and like a lake house and you weren't there, of course, he would wait, you know, and he would slip in and open the door and get in there. And then he would go through and that's where he would get his food. And that's, you know, he never harmed anybody, never even carried a weapon, never anything like that. He just legitimately kept to himself and sneak around. And when he needed things, he would sneak into town or sneak into these places and steal them. It was written, and Michael even written about him, that he was an expert, you know, with a screwdriver, knowing ways to break in, and that he would take things like, you have to imagine you got to keep your, in this cold, especially in Maine. I mean, that's a real cold. He'd take candy. Candy was always good. He writes about that he would take, potato chips, or he would try to take, meats, you know, especially in the colder weather, he would take meats. And, you know, marshmallows, things like that. If he could find coffee, he would take coffee and spices. You know, he would take sugar, or he would take salt and pepper and any kind of condiments and things that he could get his hands on. He would, you know, take back to himself out there. He would try different things. Like they said that, you know, if he would ever find, like some guys would have like shops outside, and the shops where they would keep refrigerators and stuff. And he would search all around. And if he could ever find a key, maybe, you know, stuff like that, where he didn't have to break in, where he could just sneak up and open the key and take things. It would do that. Now, certain places had, as it went on, would have different like motion detectors and things, and would get people's attention, and he would, you know, have to flee from there. And, you know, he was learning and all this as it went on. And there was a game warden named Terry Hughes, and Terry lived about a mile away from where all this activity was going down. So Terry actually got alerted to it due to a motion detector going off at one of these places. And Terry raced down there and actually found him, saw him when he had, where he had broken in, and really, and he'd been trying to catch him for years. Okay. Like he had been, this fella had been really, I guess you could say, obsessed with catching this North Pond hermit. And so when he got down to this place, when Terry got down there and heard all this commotion from this motion detector where the hermit had gone into this building, he saw him. And pretty much used his phone that he had. He called the state police, got a hold of one of the trooper named Diane. Her name's Diane Perkins Vance. And of course her too had, she was completely obsessed with trying to catch this hermit. This was a thing that had been going on. We'll get into how long this had been going on. So, he gets ready and, you know, she's headed that way. She's cruising that way. Well, you know, being a game warden, he's armed. You know, Mr. Hughes is armed. And so he takes his pistol and he takes his flashlight, and he at gunpoint stops the thief, stops the North Pond hermit, orders him down. They say that in the report, nothing happened, that he didn't resist. He didn't do anything, that he quietly, with no noise, never answered, never anything, laid on his stomach, was handcuffed. They set him in a chair, and that was it. They said that he was very pale, that he was wearing glasses that were extremely old, you know, that he wore, they said that his boots were nice, that he had a really nice jacket, nice jeans. They searched him. There was no, you know, any kind of identification in his pockets or anywhere on him, just sitting there. So Officer Perkins Vance, what a miss, the state trooper, she actually ends up taking the handcuffs off of Chris and give him a bottle of water. And she said that it took a little bit, and then he just starts talking. And she asked him, you know, why don't you want to answer any of the questions? And he said, I'm ashamed. And she said that the way he spoke wasn't the way we speak. It wasn't a normal conversation because she said it was for the lack, and Michael even writes about it, says for the lack of, I guess, anything you could really talk about, it was an atrophy from him not speaking, not carrying on a conversation with anyone, truly being alone. So they said over the next few hours, he started, you know, getting back into the groove of communicating with people, and told him who he was and that he'd been born in, you know, December of 1965 and what his name was. And they were like, you know, do you have any of this? He's like, no, I don't have a vehicle. I don't have an address. I don't have any kind of identification. I don't have anything. And they said, well, you know, she said, well, how long, Mr. Knight, have you lived in these woods? And something really interesting comes from him, and it's the way he was keeping time. He asked her, he goes, well, when was Chernobyl? When was the nuclear plant disaster? And she thinks a while. She's, you know, she sits there and she's like, I believe 1986. And he said, well, that's the same year I went into the woods. And he was 20 years old at the time. And at the time that he was caught by these two, he was 47 years old. So for 27 years, he had lived in the woods in Maine and had done getting, you know, to get by, would break into cabins to get food. If he needed clothing, if he needed things along those lines, if he didn't, he would stay out in the woods. He told her, he's like, for this whole time, I've only slept in a tent. And so she asked about cooking. He said, I never lit a fire because I knew if I lit a fire, they would see the smoke and people would come to my camp. And so I couldn't light fires. So he lived in Maine in a tent with no fire through their winters for 27 years. He goes on to say that he didn't even know if his parents were still alive. Also, that he would only move at night because that's when it was safe, that he knew nobody was out there. And if they were, they would not know the woods as well as he knew it. So he could move freely because it was like this was in his house with the lights turned down low. That was it. He said that he hasn't made a phone call. He's never been behind the wheel of a car since he was 20. He doesn't have money. He didn't even, she starts asking questions, you know, that he has no answers to, right? Absolutely no answers to as far as things going on today. So he gets arrested on the spot, charged with burglary and with theft. And he's sent to the Kennebec County Jail in Augusta there, the state capital. And it says here, and Michael writes, that for the first time in nearly 10,000 days, Christopher Knight slept indoors. Now, imagine what that must be like. Imagine going from the woods to jail after 27 years on your own in these woods. Now, it goes on to say, they start getting into it. Michael really touches great on this whole thing, and he talks about this, and this is what I find the most interesting, too, is people said that at first they thought places were haunted because they didn't know what was going on. Strange things were happening. They said that flashlights would be missing their batteries. Like, you'd get to your cabin, you couldn't tell if it had been broken in or not, but nothing had batteries in it. Or that you would get to looking around in the fridge and, like, steaks or something like that would be the only thing missing would be, you know, beef would be gone, or a pack of bacon. Like, you knew there were bacon there. You were just in it looking at yesterday. You come back home, you can't tell if anything's been broken into. Nothing's been moved or broken. Just the lock been jimmied and somebody stole a pack of bacon, just a missing pack of bacon. He even interviewed a man named David Prola. And he even said that, said, my grandkids thought I was losing my mind, is what he said, because of his vacation cabin. He said, I would have brand new propane tanks for my grill, and I would get there and they would be old ones would be in their place. I'd be like, where did my propane tanks go? And the kids thought he was messing around. And he estimates that it was at least 50 times that Christopher must have broken in or taken something from his cabin. And he wasn't the only one. More and more people, like I said, more and more people started noticing things missing or other things strange around the house. They said that you would find scratches on the door frames, that you would find like scratches and where the wood had been gouged out near window locks. Like, he wasn't just breaking glass to get in. He would literally cat burglar it, so he didn't cause a lot of commotion. But people said that, you know, somebody might be missing a frying pan one year and report that. Or like we talked about, his jacket. He had a real nice jacket. He would use one till it was wore out. Then he would just find him one he liked and take it. Same thing with his socks. The same thing with his, you know, any of his clothing. You have to imagine that's where he's getting it. If you're in the woods for that many years, for 27 years, you're not running down to the local mall with your paycheck. You know, you're not getting your money sent to you there. So you have to, you know, come up with some other way. And the only way to do it is to steal from people. People also reported that they felt like they were always being watched. And of course, I'm sure that wasn't happening, but you can imagine if more and more people are reporting all around you these strange things, not just one spot, everybody gets on edge. You know, we've talked about it. Everybody gets on edge. It's very interesting too, that they would put, you know, change their locks. They would put on, they said alarm systems would be put in, motion detectors, you know, all of this stuff, but things never seemed to really catch him. Like it was almost to a supernatural level that they really were like, I don't understand how we can't catch this, whoever this is. It's really interesting too, that Michael reports that people would leave notes written on the doors when they left that would say, please don't break in. If you tell us what you need, we will leave it out for you. So they were like, just don't break into our stuff. We'll give you some things if that's what you're looking for. Now, they did say that there was never a reply to those notes. But as these things started growing in frequency, that's when he got named the North Pond Hermit. That's when people started talking about it. They go on, and he reports that in a homeowners meeting one time back in 2002, that there was, you know, 100+ people that were there, and they started asking who has had break-ins, and over 75 of the people in this homeowners meeting started raising their hand. So you're like, 3/4 of the people here have had some kind of interaction with this North Pond Hermit. People were talking about, and he says that, you know, people started swapping stories about, you know, people getting stuff taken, candy missing. He points to one person, talks about their candy was missing when this kid was 10. All of it got stolen one day. And he said the kid's now 34 when this was going on. So these had been going on over and over and over. And it's funny because they point to, they said it got to the point that it felt supernatural, that this happened. You know, you would always think about what they call a rash of robbery. We've had a rash of robberies, or a rash of break-ins, you know, or a rash of car theft that happened, you know, for 60 days. There was people stealing cars like crazy. That happened, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. We've never seen it again. But for 27 years, off and on, this went on all constant, a constant thing. He quotes a fellow named Pete Cogswell, who happened to know that when Christopher was caught, Christopher was wearing his jeans and his belt. So he's like, I can't believe this is real. You know, this is a real thing. And they said that people, once he was arrested, didn't really eliminate the whole idea of something, you know, larger than life, but it more perpetuated it. It perpetuated the story because of one man living in the woods in a tent, a nylon tent with no fire for 27 years in these winters. So you jump forward to this whole thing, October 28th, okay, of 2013. Christopher goes up in front of the Superior Court and he pleads guilty. And he pled guilty at that time to 13 counts of theft and burglary. And at this time, he was sentenced to 7 months in jail, which Michael reports is he had served all of that but a week. So it had taken him that long to get him squared away. And that it was a far more lenient thing than before. So during this time, Michael ends up writing a letter to Christopher in that 7 month stretch that he's in prison. He handwrites a letter, and he doesn't expect anything to happen from it. And Christopher responds to that letter, and I can't even say a friendship. I can't say anything like that when you read a bunch of this stuff about it, because that's not who Christopher is. But he does respond, and he tells him, you know, what he's going through, how this, that, and the other, and how it's going, and how he's losing it, you know, in prison. It's one of those, I mean, like I said, you can imagine the quietness and now you're stuck in prison and you don't have people skills. You have 27 years of no people skills. Now you're forced to live around people that aren't necessarily good people in society to start with. Whereas, you know, you're a theft and a thief and a burglar. Yeah, that's terrible. But given the situation, you'd kind of be like, well, we don't know why you did it, but you did it. So maybe we need to talk to this guy some too. But at the time, you know, he carries it on and he actually goes and Michael went and sat down with him and actually went and took a chance. And Christopher came and talked to him through the plexiglass, not really talked to him. Like Michael talks about not making eye contact with him. You know, having the dude, Christopher was a very standoffish guy, but you can understand. Now it is interesting to know that the judge wanted to meet with Christopher after all this stuff every Monday that he couldn't drink and he had to find a job or go to school. And then if he didn't do these things, they were going to send him to prison for 7 years, folks, 7 years. So right before he got released, Michael, the man that wrote this article, goes to meet with Christopher. Okay, goes down there. And at this point, he finds out, you know, Christopher finds out his father's passed away, but that his mother's still alive and that his mother lives at the same house. So now Christopher's going to live with his mother. Now, there's a few little funny things about it is when he lived in the woods, he didn't have a beard. He was clean shaven. He kept razors. He made sure he kept his appearance up. When he was in jail, he quit shaving. He just really turned into looking. He looked more like a hermit and a wild man after serving time in prison, in jail, than he did 27 years in the main wilderness. So he called it his crazy hermit beard is what he referred to it as. And Michael even says that whenever he went to see him, that he still didn't make much eye contact, that he was very, very thin, like he wasn't eating because he wasn't sleeping well being in there. And this is some quotes I'm going to tell you, and this kind of lets you know where his mentality sits. And he told Michael, he said, "I don't know your world, only my world, and memories of the world before I went into the woods. What life is today, what is proper, I have to figure out how to live." Now, Michael says that he wanted to return to his camp. He said, "I miss the woods," but he also said, you know, that he knew that if he went back, you know, he's going to prison, so he knows he can never go back there. He said, "Sitting here in jail, I don't like what I see in the society I'm about to enter. I don't think I'm going to fit in. It's too loud. It's too colorful. The lack of aesthetics, the crudeness, the trivia." He says, "What I miss the most is somewhere between quiet and solitude. What I miss most is stillness." And Michael says that Christopher told him that he had watched for years as a shelf mushroom grew on the trunk of a Douglas fir tree there by his camp. And he said that, "I've noticed the mushroom." Now, this is it. Michael went to the camp. The man reporting on this went to Christopher's camp, saw the whole thing, went and saw the whole deal. And he told Christopher this. He's like, "I've seen the mushroom." He's like, "I know exactly which one you're talking about." He said, "It's enormous. It's a huge mushroom." And he said, "Well, is it still there? Nobody's messed with it, right?" He said, "No, man, it is still exactly where it was at. Nobody's knocked it over. Nobody's done anything with it." He said, "I have sat and looked at it myself." And he told him, he said, "I watched it grow. I sat there year after year and watched it become something." He said, "I'll tell you something else." He said, "In the heat of the summer, in the middle of the night, around midnight or so," he said, "I would sneak down to the lake." He said, "I would strip down naked." He said, "I would float out into the water flat on my back, and I would just stare up at the stars and all the quiet solitude." Now, that sounds to me ideal. And as much as I dislike the water, it still sounds extremely peaceful. It sounds like he was truly at rest with himself. Now, Michael goes on to say that he was more reflective, Christopher was, during the last visit. And he said that he told Michael that he was never happy in his youth. He said he was never happy with a job. He was never happy when he was in school, and that he was never happy being around other people. Like, he was just better off by himself. And that he discovered, you know, he said when he walked into the woods and finally found the camp that he decided, because he would just camp around in these woods. He just bounced around and bounced around for a couple years just randomly up through there till he finally found this one area that he had really, really liked. And he told Michael, he said, I found a place where I was content. And he said that it was my spot in this on this planet and that I was finally at peace with what had gone on. Now, you would think that with all this time that he had spent and the interactions with Michael that Christopher had had and the things that he had said, that it would be one of those deals, you know, like, all right, you know, well, when I get out, I'll, you know, discuss more with you or we'll talk more about it or this, that, and the other. Michael says this, said the last day, he said that this is what he'd told him, that he had grown very weary of my visits and he begged to leave me alone. And Christopher said, we are not friends. I don't want to be your friend. I don't want to be anyone's friend. And I'm not going to miss you at all. Now, Michael says, he goes, I like Chris a lot. He said, I liked the way he thought. I liked the different things they discussed. They discussed a lot of literary writings. Christopher loved to read and would steal thousands of books. Like he had thousands of books and he would read all kinds of stuff. And so that was one of the things that Michael and Chris got to talk about was Chris's reading and the books that he'd like and all this stuff. But he had told Michael that he, you know, he's like, he wanted to disappear. You know, he wanted to melt back away and get away from this world, but he knew he couldn't. He knew it was done. And Michael even talks about this. He said at the very end, he said, I told Chris, I said, goodbye, Chris. And he said, a guard appeared to take Chris away. And he said, you know, that he was waiting for Chris to respond. He said, Chris never responded. He just hung up the phone through the plexiglass. He never waved. He didn't nod. He didn't anything. He said, he stood up, he turned his back on him. And he walked out of the visitor's booth and down the corridor of the jail. And that was it. It was the last time Michael had seen Chris. So over 7 months, he had spoke to Chris multiple times, written letters, gone and interviewed him, you know, sat across the plexiglass from him multiple times. And the last time Chris told him, I'm not going to miss you at all. And I don't want to be your friend. And I don't want to ever see you again. It's over. Now, this is from the only person that reached out to Chris while he was in prison for this thing, this 7 months in jail. He hadn't seen anybody in 27 years, and Michael was making it a point to try to reach out to him, and this is all that he wanted. So there's some other things that was reported on that said that he was on the spectrum for, I believe it's Asperger's. And that they believe that he, you know, had some other things, maybe, you know, that he was a little bit unstable or maybe even autistic to a level. And that that's where some of this solitude came from, is he didn't have to have that in his life. He removed it from his life and found a way to get by with it. But I think it's one of those deals. The reason I say this one is this one wasn't self-imposed. I mean, this one was self-imposed, where Agafia's was not. She was born into it. She was born into solitude and chose it over this world. He was born into this world and chose the solitude. The common denominator is this world, is if you get away from the hustle and the bustle and you take the stressors out of your life, it seems like people are a lot happier without those stressors. They're a lot happier being relaxed, being with either only yourself or only very close with your family. Like Christopher wasn't close with his family, but he was very close with himself. He knew who he was, and he was happy with that. Agafia was born into the family and was very, very happy. Her mother died for her. Her brother died so he wouldn't leave the family. They never were separated because that was their tribe. And I firmly believe that there's something to that tribe. Like with your friends or your family, you should have your own tribe. And your tribe is what keeps you strong. Don't worry about all the social media. Don't worry about all the nonsense. Your tribe is what keeps you strong. And that's what kept Agafia strong and his personal tribe. He's a lone warrior for Christopher. He's the old rogue bull. He's just out there living it. And that's the way it was. Now, I hope you enjoyed it. I have another couple of stories I may share later on. Speaking of tribes and some more of hermits, but I've always been fascinated with it. And I've always felt like I could relate to that, whether I was by myself or had a small tribe with me. And I think each of you listening are thinking right now about that tribe. Do you have your tribe? Would you be okay out there? Would you, because really and truly life was meant to be lived and you not to be a slave to your environment. And I feel like we've gotten away from that. So if anything, if you draw from this, get outdoors, folks. The weather's getting better. Go to the park. Go take a walk. Get outside and look at the stars. Enjoy your time here. It's very limited. Enjoy it. Let's take a quick break. When we get back, we'll wrap this baby up. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
All right. Yes. I hope y'all enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I had talked about that, the Vice documentary on YouTube about the Lokovs or whatnot.
Donkeys? Is that the Vice documentary you're talking about? The one about donkeys?
You did tell me about that one, but you told me about the one where the woman was in Siberia.
Yeah.
And that's what had gotten me down the path. And I watched the documentary and did the whole thing, and they're making the movie about her, Agafia or whatnot. I always mess everything up thinking back right now, unless it's in front of me. But, you know, like I said, she was born and raised out there. She didn't know any better. You get into Christopher Knight, the hermit. He chose that life. He walked out in there. And there's been several people that have walked out in and just become hermits, just decided, this is as far as I go. I'm done with it. I don't want to deal with that stuff anymore. And it's just funny to see.
It would be hard to do, but there are days where I'm like, yeah, I could totally do that.
Yeah, that's well, and that's the reason I did those two stories, is they both are devoted hermits.
Yeah.
But one was born to it, one chose it, yet right. They both still had the same feeling. It's not, that's what I was getting at, is you would think that if you were born to it and didn't know what you had, and then you moved back into town, you'd be like, oh, I'm never living out in the woods again. But that's not what she did. She had to get back in the woods. This man chose to leave the woods and still wanted to get, so there's really no difference. If you have that drive to be away from society, it doesn't matter how you get there. You just have to get there. You have to get out in those woods. So it's one of those. I have another story I'll end up sharing with y'all coming up here real quick about one that took place in the 1800s along those lines. Not kind of like the Robinson Crusoe type thing,
right,
but
right.
A lot like that. But it's one of those deals that I romanticize personally the hermit stories. Like for something about, I don't know why it is. I mean, I do. I used to dream about it as a child, is just being like Jeremiah Johnson. You just being out like a mountain man all alone,
chopping up in the wilds of Alaska. Canning vegetables
just,
and fruit and stuff.
You're just up in the wilds of Alaska.
Setting snares and tanning hides. That would be, kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's one of those deals.
But a lot of people are social. So like that would be the hardest part. Now, obviously, it only works for people that aren't very social, very introverted people. I think it would be hard to go, like for a short amount of time, it'd be fun. But I do think after a while, you'd be like, man, I miss like talking to somebody. So if you had a family, I think it would be okay. But just by yourself, that'd be a little bit rough.
I don't know.
I don't know either. But I just can imagine if it's just you and the dog, you might start going crazy.
Well, I'm sure you would. I mean, at one point you would end up, you'd probably be slipping. But then again,
on the other end of the spectrum, like people living in the rat race in a cubicle or a stockbroker in
Wall Street. Are they any crazier?
I mean, to me, that sounds horrible.
Yeah. Well, I always think back too of Tom Hanks in Castaway. It's one of my favorite films.
Yeah.
Because of how long he's there and how he adapts and how he, deals with what it is. And finally, he's had enough. He's like, I'm either going to die or I'm going to find salvation to get off this island because I'm not staying here any longer.
Did you watch the movie with him, Sully?
I have not
Captain
seen
Sullenberg.
That.
No. It's a pretty good movie. It's I didn't know a lot about the case because I just wasn't paying attention to it. But what's funny about it is it's so typical. He ends up saving everybody on the plane, right? Mm-hmm. He lands it in the Hudson. Everybody survives. What's the airline immediately do? He's been a pilot for them for like 27 years. They start trying to sue him. They start trying to figure out a way because he messed up their plane that it wasn't his fault. I mean, they were trying to make it look like it was his fault. Wow. That he could have safely made it back. I mean, it evidently ended up where that he was exonerated of everything.
Yeah.
But how about just focus on the fact that the guy was able to save everybody?
Save some people, yeah.
I mean, they have insurance, right, on those planes?
Just so,
I mean,
a plane.
It's a plane. Do you know the person named Shane Anthony Melee? Are you familiar with this person?
I don't think so. Well, should I know him?
No, he's an idiot. He was arrested on February 1st in North Palm Beach, Florida. Check this guy
Florida
out.
Florida man.
He had a buddy named Michael Johnson. Now, his buddy Michael Johnson kind of...
Isn't that the fastest man alive at one time that wore the gold shoes?
Yeah, but that's not him. That's okay. Not that guy. This is another guy, but this guy's well off, and he employed Shane Anthony Melee. You know, he's trying to do him a favor. Well, all he did was work for him for a couple weeks, and he saw that his boss had some valuable stuff, and he ripped a guy off. He stole $33,000 worth of coins, rare coins.
Well, first of all, where do you go fence something like that without somebody knowing you've stolen those coins from somebody else?
Well, get this. The guy took the $33,000 worth of coins. He didn't know they were worth that and traded them in at those little Coinstar vending machines.
No.
He got $29 for it. He had no idea he had $33,000. Oh. And of course, when he turned them into Coinstar, the person that empties the machines was like, well, these are really rare coins. So they were able to go back and watch footage and catch the guy. So how funny is that, right? It's kind of ironic. He said he stole it because he needed money. He didn't realize he had $33,000 worth of rare coins. So now the man is in prison.
We have a listener, a buddy of mine named Jason Tucker. He runs Automatic Tattoo down there. I believe that's the name of it, but it's in Melbourne, Florida, folks. So if any of y'all are down there looking to get inked, go check out our buddy Jason down there. You can get Jason Tucker Tattoo on Instagram. But he and I, we send each other Florida man messages on the reg. So there's constantly stuff I find or he'll find and he'll just be like, we're at it again down here. I'll find something crazy. I'll be like, you're going to have to get your guys under control down there because Florida is a wacky place.
Yes.
Now, and I like it. Dude, I love going down there fishing and going there and hang. But it's its own country, man.
It is. It's
its own country.
And I need to make a correction. On the last OTC show, I was going off about the Oscars and stuff, and I might have said something that wasn't true, and because I was ranting, I misspoke, and I said that being an actor is not a hard job. And I thought about it, and I have friends that are actors, like my buddy Logan Huffman. It's definitely a hard job. What I meant is it's not as hard as physical labor, like pouring hot asphalt on a hot day in Arizona.
There you go.
It's not as hard. There's a degrees.
There's levels to this
game. And right. So I might have misspoken there. I was having a bad day. You know how it is.
I hope everyone didn't mind the joke.
But the cursing?
Joke. Yeah.
I don't think it's a problem. I mean.
But I've got another joke for you.
Does it involve cursing?
There's no cursing.
Okay, good. No
There's
cursing.
There's no cursing in this joke.
All right, let's hear it. Is this going to be the new segment now?
I don't know.
Of every
funny.
Show, we finish with a joke? Okay.
This is funny because it's something that I had heard a long, long time ago. And I'm trying to think where I have heard it. I want to say it was a Jerry Clower bit. Remember old Jerry Clower?
Yeah, yeah.
I want to say it was something along those lines. But my mother had asked me about it the other day when we were talking, and she brought something up, and I told her the whole story, and she was laughing, and she's like, I can't remember where it come from. So I'll try to tell you as best I can remember. If it's Mr. Clower's, the late great, I'm sorry, this is how it goes. It's something along the lines of a young boy. We'll use the name Kyle.
Okay.
Kyle decides he's going off to college, right? So his mom and dad scrape all their money together and they send him off to college. Kyle gets down to college. He's doing okay in college, but he's partying pretty hard, right? And he spends up a lot of his money. So he's like, how am I going to get some more money? So he calls his dad up and he knows his dad has got an old hound dog. This old hound dog is his favorite hound dog, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this, I mean, it's his pride and joy, old Spark. So he calls him up and he's like, Dad, I need you to do me a favor. He's like, yeah, what do you need? He goes, we're doing a new thing here in the science programs. And he goes, they're going to teach Spark how to read. And his dad's like, what? He's like, all I need you to do is put that dog on the train and send me $1,000. And he goes, that goes into the research. And he goes, we're going to teach Spark how to read. He's like, done. Done. Wait for him at the train. I'm sending it to him. And his dad's so excited. I'm going to have the only dog that knows how to read in all these counties. So he sends old Spark out there, gives him the money. Boom, gone. The boy burns through the money, you know. And after a while, he's like, oh, what am I going to do? He goes, I got it. So he calls his dad back up. He's like, Dad, you wouldn't believe it. Spark's top of the class. Reads more than anybody else. This dog is unbelievable. He goes, I need $3,000. We're going to teach him how to talk. So he's like, oh, done. You're going to teach him how to talk. I've always wanted to be able to talk to my best buddy. My hunt, done. Here comes the money. So he sends him $3,000. Well, now it's getting close to Christmas. The boy's burned up all this money. He's got to go home for Christmas, and he's just got this hound dog.
Yeah.
So he's like, what am I going to do? So the boy gets on the train. He's riding it back home. He don't know what he's going to do, and he knows his dad's waiting. His dad's super excited to get this dog back. The boy gets off the train, and the dad's looking. He's like, son, it's great to see you. Where's old Spark? He goes, Dad, you're not going to believe this. He goes, well, what is it? And he's like, well, we spent all this time teaching him how to read and teaching him how to talk. And he said, we were coming back. And he said, he's been talking my leg off about it. He couldn't wait to see you and Mom. He couldn't wait to tell y'all some stuff. And he had all these things to talk. And he said, we were riding the train. He's reading the Wall Street Journal. And he said, he looks over the top of the Wall Street Journal at me. And he goes, you know what, Kyle? He said, I sure can't wait to get home and tell your mama all those times that your daddy was cheating on her with Miss Wilson that lived next door. And he said, Dad, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe the one dog, the one thing that you've given all your love to and all your trust to would do that to you, would turn on you, making up these lies. He said, I just couldn't deal with it. And he said, Dad, I just panicked. I grabbed him and I threw him off the moving train. He's like, Spark's dead. I killed him, Dad. I killed him for that. Old dad leaned back and he goes, I don't know what to think. He's, I just got one question. Are you sure you killed that lion, son of a bitch?
Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
Man. So that was the story.
What do you got? Yeah. What else you got planned for your week?
I'm trying to think. I don't know what I've got. I've got my great niece has got a soccer game coming up. I have my daughter and my wife have got something else planned. This whole weekend is booked with everything that doesn't involve me. So I'm okay with that because in the next couple of weeks, I've got weddings. I've got all kinds of stuff coming up on the next few weeks. But this weekend, I think I would like to be building some arrows, but the arrows haven't gotten here yet. So
yeah,
I think they've sent them by Raven and they're going to bring one at a time till they get them piled up. I don't know, but I'm working on shooting bows and staying warm. That's pretty much what I'm working on.
I'm going to be definitely trying to stay warm. We've got our first baseball tournament of the year. So I'll be out there doing that. We're going to be in Plano, Texas. You know what kind of baseball fields they have in Plano?
I heard they were just plain old baseball
fields.
Plain
old fields. That's right. Don't forget about our sponsor, Shudder. You can get to try Shudder yourself for 30 days for free. Just go to Shudder.com and use the promo code EXPANDED. If you have any stories of your own you'd like to share with me and Cam, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com or you can call the show 817-945-3828. Also, don't forget about Expanded Perspectives Elite. Go over there. You have to go to the website, expandedperspectives.com, and click on the Elite tab. $5 a month, folks, and you get the entire back catalog as well as extra shows every month. Till next time, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.